Hi, everyone. I hope you're having a fantabulous day. Before we jump into this week's episode, I have just two quick little things I want to throw out there. Number one, could I ask a huge favor? Only if you are enjoying this podcast, could you please take 2 minutes out of your crazy busy day to subscribe and write a review on Apple Podcast? I would be so grateful and appreciative. Unless you hate it, then keep your opinion to your damn self. JK, JK. No, honestly, though, I'd be very appreciative. Number two. So today's episode is a part two. So if you were not able to listen to last week's episode yet, which was titled Piketon Murders Part One, please stop this episode now and go back and listen to that first. I mean, you could listen to this one first, but I think you'll be hella confused by what's going on. Okay, that was your warning. Last chance. Turn it off now. Spoiler alert in 3, 2, 1. All right. For those of you who are left, you know the dealio. If you are ready for a mind-blowing ride, grab your cup of tea or coffee, beer, soda. Sit back and buckle up, because this is the story of the Piketon Murders, part two. Okay, it's been a weekish since the last time we met. So let's do a quick recap to make sure you're still up to speed. Last week, we learned about the massacre of 8 members of the Roden family. The name and age of the victims are as follows. 40-year-old Chris Roden Sr. His wife, 37-year-old Dana Roden. Their 3 children, 20-year-old Frankie Roden, 19-year-old Hannah Roden, 16-year-old Chris Roden Jr., Frankie Roden's fiance, 20-year-old Hannah Gilley, Chris Roden Sr.'s older brother, 44-year-old Kenneth Roden, and Chris Roden Sr.'s cousin, 38-year-old Gary Roden. When we left each other last week, I had told you that finally, 2 years after the murders, 6 people from the Wagner family were arrested and charged with the crimes. Needless to say, the Wagners are a huge part of this story. However, we're not actually going to start with them. Before we focus all of our attention on the Wagners, I want to fill you in on the other theories that police investigated prior to the arrest of the Wagners. Theory number one, a hit by the Mexican drug cartel. As we mentioned last week, when police arrived at the crime scenes, it was discovered that 3 of the 4 locations had, quote, commercial marijuana grow operations. The police recovered an estimated street value of between $400,000 and $500,000 worth of weed. In my opinion, one of the reasons police strongly suspected the cartel was because of the brutality of the crime. I mean, dang, who else could commit such an absolutely brutal crime? Certainly not anyone who lives in Piketon, right? I mean, there's no way one of our own could commit such a horrific crime, right? Another reason the police suspected the cartel was because these murders were an execution. The crimes themselves were so calculated and precise. It was hard to believe that someone who wasn't a professional hitman could pull off something of this magnitude. I mean, think about it. Someone, or someones, went to 4 locations in just a few hours and executed 8 people while they slept. Also, keep in mind that beside Chris Sr.'s house, all of the victims were found in bed, most likely asleep. I mean, that takes freaking skill to pull off, you know? Why was the theory of the Mexican drug cartel debunked? So there were a few reasons that police shifted their focus away from this theory. One reason is, and as cruel as this sounds, the cartel would not have left the children alive, and these killers did. In Frankie and Hannah Gilley's bed, their six-month-old lay between them. Their killer literally shot around the baby to get to his parents. Between the two, they were shot 8 times. My point is that it was not an accident that the baby was left alive. Whomever did this had some tiny, itsy-bitsy, teeny-weeny yellow polka dot bikini shred of compassion in them, I guess. Or at least they wanted people to think so. Another reason they moved on from the cartel theory is because even though it sounds like a lot to me and you, $400,000 worth of pot probably ain't shit to the Mexican drug cartel. You know, you hear all the time about millions and millions of dollars of drugs being seized at the borders, things like that. Would the cartel risk bringing the attention of 8 savage murdered Americans to their own doorstep? The detectives did not seem to think so. Theory number 2. Murder by a family member. This is also known as family annihilation. This theory was thought of early on for 2 reasons. The first reason is simply statistics. You are more likely to be murdered by someone you know, like a family member, than you are by a stranger. The other reason was that, remember when I said they couldn't find Chris Jr. for a period of time after the murders? Well, originally, Chris Jr. was under the microscope as a potential suspect. If you remember from last week, this is part of the story I feel like there has to be more to. I have thought this through 1,000,001 different times, and I cannot figure out for the life of me why it took the cops so long to find Chris Jr.'s body in the house. Per protocol, the first thing the cops would have done is secure the premises. Part of securing the premises would mean clearing the house, going room to room, making sure there were no suspects, additional victims, survivors in the house. So why couldn't they find him for so long? It's not like they found him in the woods or, you know, out back, outside, in a vehicle, nothing like that. They found him in the house with his mom and sister. The police have been so secretive and protective of the crime scene detail. I am really interested to learn more about this specifically at the trial. Theory number 3, murder-suicide. There was a brief talk about a murder-suicide. Again, statistically, you are more likely to be murdered by someone you know than a stranger. This theory is plausible, as the last victim to be found, Kenneth Roden, had only 1 gunshot through his right eye, indicating that he could have killed his family, returned home. He could have killed his family, returned home, and committed suicide. The problem with this theory is that they couldn't find a single shred of evidence to support this or any type of reason why Kenneth would have wanted to harm his family. So although it was looked into, the detectives eventually moved on from this theory. Theory number 4, the fight between Chris Jr. and Rusty Mongold. 10 days before the murders, Chris Jr. got into some type of altercation or road rage incident with a 19-year-old local named Rusty Mongold. It's a bit unclear to me exactly what happened between them. But on April 12th, again, 10 days before the murder, at 2:58 p.m., Rusty posted the following message to his Facebook account. God, I can't stop thinking about this kid that hit me with a car. Every time I see a silver Tiburon, I get pumped and ready to beat his skull in. But, of course, none of them are him. But I'm not worried. We will get all of them. Someone even made the comment under the post that said, "Was it Chris Roden? LOL." to which Rusty Mongold replied, yes. Of course, police were on this kid like white on rice. A message like this, posted just 10 days before the murders happened, they scrutinized and questioned the absolute crap out of this kid. After a lot of speculation and attention, it was determined that Rusty did not have anything to do with the murders. On April 23rd at 3:27 a.m., so I don't know, 24, we don't know exactly when they died, but 24 hours-ish after the murders, Rusty posted another Facebook message, which read as follows, quote, okay, to everyone falsely accusing me of having anything to do with the shooting, I did not. A few weeks ago, I met the Roden family, and yes, there was a conflict where we tried to fight each other, but that lasted a couple days, and after that, we dropped it. And I was at work from 11 p.m. till 7:30 a.m. There are cameras and everything with proof of that. I also went to the sheriff's office to clear my name. I gave them DNA and everything. I have nothing to hide. I was at work and everyone saying it was me, please keep my name out of your mouth because I would never wish death on anyone, nor shoot anyone, and I'm very sorry for everyone's loss. I know they were great people and I wish we met on better terms the night we were fighting, but I have said what I know to help and I hope you guys find him and I'm sorry for everyone's loss. I will talk to anyone to help you guys get through this. I am very sorry for everyone. I'll pray for you guys. End quote. There were a few other theories that people looked into. That the detectives looked into. I guess Chris Sr. had some type of traffic altercation a few weeks leading up to the deaths. They also looked heavily at Bobby Joe, who, remember, is Dana's sister, since she discovered the bodies of Chris Sr., Gary, Frankie, and Hannah Gilley. Additionally, Bobby Joe made the initial 911 call. The police heavily, heavily scrutinized poor Bobby Joe. They also gave her multiple lie detector tests, to which she passed all of them. They also looked at James Manley. So James, remember, is the brother of Dana Roden and Bobby Joe Manley. He discovered the bodies of Dana and Hannah. From what I could tell, they looked at him for three reasons. One, he was a close family member. Two, he discovered one of the crime scenes. And three, police allege that at 2 a.m., on the morning of the murders, James Manley sent a text message to Jake Wagner. What? Alarm bells flying off right now, right? The first time I heard that or read it, I was like, whoa, 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 what? I have researched this tirelessly, and I can't even find a rumor on it, let alone fact, of what this text message said. So I cannot wait for this specific piece of evidence to come out during the trial. Regardless of what it said, though, James Manley swears that it was sent the day before, but due to crappy cell phone service, it did not go through until 2 a.m. the morning of April 22nd. In other words, James says he didn't send the message at 2 a.m. the night of the murders. Because of this, the police put a tracking device on James Manley's car. James found the tracker, removed it from his vehicle, and destroyed it. Because of this, the police arrested James for vandalism and tampering with evidence. Charges against James were later dropped. Theory 4. Other unsolved murders in Piketon, Ohio. Okay. Let's please be reminded that Piketon, Ohio has a population of just over 2,000 people. So we are not talking about a large city. We are talking about a tiny little village. So when 8 people are murdered in their beds while they sleep, it's a big freaking deal. You know what's even crazier? When you learn that it's not the first time a crime like this has happened in Piketon. What? On December 9th, 2006, Jennifer Burkett and her fiancé, Curtis Francis, were in the home they shared together in Piketon, Ohio. Like the Rodens, this young couple was asleep in their bed when an intruder entered the house and shot the young couple as they slept, killing them both. Just for S&Gs, I Googled the distance between the crime scene to the Rodens' property, and it's just over 10 miles from each other. So they're close. To this day, the double homicide remains unsolved. The case is still open, but unfortunately sits on the cold case shelf at the Pike County Sheriff's Department. According to law enforcement, the case has been reopened multiple times by both the Pike County Sheriff's Department and the Ohio Attorney General's Office. Although they aren't 100% sure, the police think that the person or persons who did this were after 2 things: money and drugs. Big surprise, right? I guess Curtis had just had shoulder surgery and had some pain meds at the house. Additionally, he had recently received some type of settlement check and had told people about it. In a 2012 interview, his mother felt sure this is what the intruders were after or were looking for that night. I'm not sure exactly how much money we are talking about, but I certainly can't imagine taking 2 innocent people's lives over a few oxy pills left over after a shoulder surgery. You know, it's disgusting to think about. Also, I'd like to take this time to go on record saying that if anything bad were ever to happen to me, I certainly hope it doesn't happen in Pike County, Ohio. Ay, ay, ay. Okay. Theory number 5, someone the Rodens knew. As the initial shock of the murders started to wear down, the evidence made its way to the surface. Investigators began to learn more and more about what had happened. A few things became evident to the police. 1, there was more than 1 killer. And 2, whoever did this had very intimate knowledge of the Roden family. This is where we pick back up with the Wagners. Wagners enter stage left. Okay, let's talk about the Wagners for a bit. Quick fact check. There are 6 Wagners in this story. 47-year-old Billy Wagner, his wife, 48-year-old Angela Wagner, their 2 boys, 27-year-old George and 26-year-old Jake Wagner, and then both Billy and Angela's mothers, 76-year-old Frederica Wagner and 65-year-old Rita Newcomb. The first thing to know about the Wagner family is that they were not hurting for cash. They weren't just doing okay either. The fact is, they were very well off. Frederica, Billy's mother, seemed to be the brains behind the operation. For their wealth, I should say, not their crimes. I guess she and her late husband became independently wealthy by buying, selling, and renting real estate. She owned almost 1,800 acres of land, valued at more than $4 million. They also had more than 130 land contracts and a beautiful horse breeding farm called the Flying W. The second thing to know about the Wagners is that they were very well liked in the community. honestly, they were thought of as a pillar of the community. The entire family, especially Billy's mom, Frederica, and Angela Wagner, were known for their selflessness and caring nature. According to so many friends, Frederica Wagner was an absolute peach. She paid for a new church in the community. She would constantly donate her time and finances to all sorts of ongoing community projects. Some of the properties she owned were extremely low income. Frederica would cook meals twice a week for the children that lived in these complexes to make sure they were able to eat at least two good meals each week. As in every story, though, there are three sides to the story. Or three sides. Mine, theirs, and the truth, so to speak. I say this because there were some folks in good old Piketon that didn't feel the same way about the Wagners. They felt that Frederica was money hungry and didn't mind taking advantage of people who were down on their luck. For example, I read an article from the Inquirer, which is the Cincinnati newspaper, which was published in November 2018. The article said that Frederica had one specific piece of property that had four different prospective buyers for it in a very short amount of time. So let me help put some context around this statement. The Wagners did a lot of these lease-to-own deals with people in their community. So for those of you who are not familiar with this type of deal, here is typically how it goes down. You have a person who is interested in purchasing a piece of land. For whatever reason, they cannot purchase it outright. Maybe they have bad credit. Maybe they can't get a loan from the bank. Maybe they don't have cash. Who knows? Could be any number of reasons. So what happens is that they will engage in one of these lease-to-own deals with the owner of the property. So the person who wants to buy the land will make monthly rent payments to the property owner. What sucks for the buyer, though, is two things. One, the high interest rate. The seller will typically charge a very high interest rate to the buyer because they know that this is really the buyer's only chance at owning a piece of property. In other words, the buyer has no other choice. The second thing that sucks for the buyer is that if you don't pay that monthly lease, the property goes back to the landowner, and whatever money you put into it, the seller gets to keep. It's a lot like the furniture, appliance store, rent-a-center, but for land. Frederica Wagner did a lot of these deals. So in this specific case that I'm talking about, there was one piece of land that Frederica had in a lease-to-own contract four separate times in a very short period. Each time, the potential buyer would miss a payment and she would snatch the property back. So I guess it depends on which lens you look through, on how you view this type of deal. Some might say, hey, like, it's not Frederica's fault. They screwed up so bad in the past that they're, you know, unable to get a regular loan from a bank with a low or decent interest rate. Others would say it's totally taking advantage of someone who already, obviously, is down on their luck. The article said she would charge between 10 and 13% interest on these deals. Just for S&Gs, I looked up the average interest rate in 2018, and it looked like it was anywhere between 4.25 and 6% for a parcel of land. So you figure she was charging her clients double. Okay, I'm sorry. We have spent way too much on Frederica, and she has one of the lesser charges. All right, moving on. Angela Wagner and Rita Newcomb, who's Angela's mom, seem to have the same reputation around town. Sweet and kind. They greatly cared for their families and others. They were good women, positive, kind-hearted, and genuine. Allegedly, when Angela found out about the murders, she wept and wept, stating that Hannah was, quote, like a daughter to me, end quote. Billy Wagner had a reputation like his mom's, who's Frederica, meaning the answer you get depends on the person you ask. Some would say Billy Wagner was a God-fearing, extremely hard-working man who put his family and friends first. They said if there was anything someone needed, they could go to him for help. The other half of the community did not feel the same way, though. They said he was gruff, hard to get along with, and very controlling of Angela, his wife, and George and Jake, their boys. Lastly are the two boys, George and Jake. The boys, just a year apart in their birth, were close to each other. From what I read, both were good men who deeply cared for their family and friends. George had a great sense of humor, and like his dad, Jake would do anything for his family. So, if the Wagners, who seem like the all-American family, are so great, how in the hell did they get caught up in Ohio's biggest criminal homicide investigation in the state's history? Well, I'm going to tell you how. And big surprise, it all started when boy met girl. Jake, the youngest Wagner, and Hannah, the rodent's only daughter and middle child, met and began dating when Hannah was just 13 years old. Remember, at the time of their deaths, Hannah was just 19 and Jake was 26. So please, do some quick math with me. Jake is almost 7 years older than Hannah. So if Hannah was 13 years old when she started dating Jake, that would make Jake, yes, almost 20 years old when they started dating. He should be sitting in jail for that alone, but I guess the 8 murders he's being accused of committing took the spot of the rape charge. Sorry, I had a mini tantrum there. Anyways, let's just pretend that it was okay for the two of them to be together and move on from it. Because I could go off on it all day. All right, so apparently they had a pretty good relationship. And I'm rolling my eyes and biting my tongue as I say that. It was not a quick whirlwind romance either. They had a pretty good relationship for a few years. I guess they were very close, and people said when they were together, you could tell that they were in love with each other. They were respectful and kind to one another. They spent equal time at each other's homes as well, so both families knew the other half well, as in the Wagners knew Hannah well, and the Rodens knew Jake well. As any normal relationship progresses, again, I'm squeezing my lips together so tight right now, the two began a sexual relationship. And to no one's real surprise, Hannah ends up pregnant. It sounded to me, too, in my research, it sounded like this was a planned pregnancy, that this was not a whoopsie or a mistake, that this is something that they were intending to do. At some point, and I couldn't really lock down a firm date, Jake proposes to Hannah, to which she accepts. So, 9 months go by, and they welcome a beautiful baby girl named Sophia into the world. For the first year, everything is going pretty darn well for their little family. Jake is working, Hannah's in school and raising this little baby. And then, to no one's surprise, Hannah, who is now a 17-year-old girl, decides that she no longer wants to be in a relationship with Jake. In normal teenage girl land, this would not be such a big deal. This happens to every teenage girl on the planet. Meet, fall in love, break up, repeat. Right? That's just the fact of life. It's a little more difficult, though, when you're engaged and you have a baby. So, after the breakup, two things were clear. Hannah was not interested in a relationship with Jake, and Jake wasn't interested in his family being broken up. From what I read, we will give Jake an A for effort when it came to trying to win back the heart of Hannah Roden. Hannah just wasn't having it, though. Not only did she not want to be with Jake anymore, but she had moved on from Jake as well. Soon after the breakup, she started dating another man named Charlie Gilley. Now, if that name sounds familiar to you, it's because you are awesome and have been really paying attention. There's another Gilley in the story that we've already met, Hannah Gilley. Remember, Hannah Gilley is the fiance of Frankie Roden, who is Hannah Roden's older brother. Oh my gosh, are you with me? So, Charlie Gilley, Hannah's new boyfriend, is the brother of Hannah Gilley, who again is Hannah Roden's older brother Frankie's fiance. Okay, pause for effect. All right. What adds another layer of complexity to this story is that Hannah Roden becomes pregnant. What makes it even more complicated is that Hannah was sleeping with both Charlie and Jake in the same short amount of time. That being said, she was not 100% certain who the father of the baby was. From what I read, Hannah was open with Jake in telling him that she was not sure who the father of baby number two was. Jake was so laser focused on getting his family back, he told Hannah that he didn't care if the baby was his or not. He wanted all four of them to be together. Unfortunately for him, Hannah did not feel the same way and officially broke off all romantic ties with Jake. I haven't been able to figure out why, but for some reason, Hannah starts to restrict Jake's time with Sophia. This, according to Jake's friends and family, sent him into a downward spiral. But, I mean, damn! This type of story happens all the time, right? Could one breakup and one custody dispute seriously be the spark that ignited the slaughter of 8 people? After 2 years of investigative work, police believe that is exactly what happened. Now, they just need to prove it. The next thing we're going to look at is the evidence of this case. In my opinion, there are two topics that are frustrating about this case, and both are for the same very good reason. The first is that the autopsy reports were heavily redacted. So the word redacted means to censor or obscure part of a text for legal or security purposes. I'm not sure why they so heavily redacted the autopsy reports, but I have read all 66 pages of them. They have only released the most basic information for each victim. The second topic that is frustrating is that since the Wagners have not yet been to trial, police have withheld a lot of information. I totally get the reason they need to do this, but it's frustrating for the public because they want to know what happened that night. So I've spent a lot of time trying to piece together how you go from a typical breakup to the plot and murder of 8 people. What could the motive possibly be, you know? Police are saying custody, but geez, I don't know. What do you guys think? It's not even like police are saying Jake himself went off the deep end and did this. They're saying 6 people did this. It just doesn't make sense to me. Take Jake's older brother, George, for example. How could a custody dispute over his niece, it's not even his child, convince him to murder 8 people? You know what I mean? It just doesn't make sense. Needless to say, once these cases go to trial, I plan on following them all very, very closely. Something tells me there will be a lot of bombshells in this case. If the prosecution wants a conviction, they will have to pull some major evidence out of their hat. Because remember, in America, you are A, innocent until proven guilty, and B, all the defense needs to do is place reasonable doubt in the mind of the jury. That's it. Reasonable doubt. Okay, so that being said, what evidence do we know about? Here's what we know. The timing of this podcast couldn't be better, as George Wagner, the older child of Billy and Angela, appeared in court just this past week. Ryan Scheiderer, I think is how you say his last name, who was a special agent with the Ohio Bureau of Investigation, stated that they have ballistic evidence, shoe prints, forged documents, recorded conversations, and text messages on George. He said shoe prints were found in the blood on the crime scene, on the floor of the crime scene. The ballistic evidence includes shell casings from 40, 30, and 22 caliber guns that ended the lives of the rodents. So, when is trial? All four of the Wagners, who were charged with the homicides, have waived their right for a speedy trial. This was based on the advice of their attorneys. There is so much evidence to sort through. Their defense needed more time preparing for the case. It looked like things were progressing, but then, of course, COVID-19 popped up, which further delayed and totally derailed the trials. As of this moment, we do not know the date of the trials, but it has to be very, very soon. This story has my absolute full attention. I will update you as this story continues to unfold. Please make sure to follow me on Facebook and Twitter for updates. Additionally, I promise to do a follow-up podcast once there's more information to share. I hope so much that you enjoyed this two-part series. Please, please, please let me know what you think by leaving a comment or review. It would mean the world to me. Also, if you know of a story that you think I might be interested in, please drop me a line and let me know. That's where this story came from, a recommendation from my aunt. I'm still new to this, so I want to report on stories that people actually care about. So definitely let me know. I must give the people what they want. All right, guys, take care. Until next time.